Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week is Blair Horner, the Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. He's back again, and are we glad he is. Welcome, Blair. You're a big part of this program. We so appreciate your work.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Alan. Good talking to you.
Blair, what is the New York Public Interest Research Group, and what do you do?
Oh, the trick question first. NYPIRG, which is the acronym, is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit research and advocacy organization. We work on a wide range of issues at the state capitol primarily, but we do some work sometimes at the local government level and sometimes in Washington. It's a public education and advocacy group, and we try to, as best we can, take on the powers to be.
In that capacity, being as honest as I know you always are, do you find yourself closer to the Democratic position or the Republican position in the way things work?
Well, it depends. I mean, certainly since there's a unified Democratic government in New York now, we work on a lot more bills that become law than we did when the government was split between the two political parties. And, you know, how much of that is policy and how much of that is, you know, the sort of the shenanigans of how Albany operates, where, you know, people hold bills hostage to try to get stuff from other people. Who knows? I mean, New York is a blue state, and so even the Republicans generally are interested in the types of issues we work on, but we're strictly nonpartisan, and we arrive at our policy conclusions based on the best available evidence or best science in terms of what public policy should be.
Well, so, Blair, what has nonpartisan come to represent? When you say you're strictly nonpartisan, you know, my guess is you're closer to the Democrats than to the Republicans. You're going to probably fight back against that, but am I right?
Well, nonpartisan means we don't endorse candidates, we don't make campaign contributions, we don't try to highlight people to get them reelected. Sometimes we're not even nice to them. So that's what nonpartisan is from our perspective. In terms of the policies, I mean, now that the Democrats control the state government, of course, our policies are more aligned with the Democrats. But when there was a split government, you had to have Republican support in order to get anything done. So in that case, you know, you could argue that it was 50-50. So, you know, it's always hard to tell because the focus of our focus on public policy is around the issues that we think are most important to the public. And we try to arrive at our policy conclusions based on facts and science, not ideology or partisanship.
Okay, I'm glad you said that. So let me go back to the couple of words you just used. We think that. Who's the we and how do you think collectively?
Well, that's a very good question. The we is, you know, we have boards, of course, in both, but the we really is essentially the product of nearly 50 years of working in New York State. And so, like barnacles on a ship, you know, we have adopted policy positions over time that create sort of the guardrails for our organization. So you look out for the, you know, the interests of consumers versus businesses, because consumers tend to be underrepresented at the state capitol, and businesses tend to be very well represented at the capitol. When it comes to environmental issues, you focus on what's the best science that protects the public health more than you protect the rights of, industries to pollute. When it comes to democracy, you look at ways to try to enhance people's participation in government, governmental policymaking, even if it means that the people in government hate the idea. So it is sort of, in a evolutionary series of positions, but we've been around for 50 years, this year actually, and so we've sort of developed policy positions that the organization, you know, follows consistently. That doesn't mean we never change position, but it's pretty rare that we do.
I want to thank you, Blair, for being around for all of those years. I didn't even know you were that old.
Now we're getting into the grumpy old men part of the conversation, hey, Alan?
Indeed, and I take great pleasure in doing that, especially with you.
Yeah, me too.
The New York State budget is late this year, blowing past the April 1st deadline. We're hearing bail reform and housing are two of the major issues they're negotiating. Is a late budget bad for New Yorkers?
Well, you know, of course, it depends on how late is late. But, I mean, in recent years, the budget has blown past the April 1st deadline, and the budget usually gets wrapped up in the first half of April. And so if you do that right, it's no harm, no foul in terms of the delivery of services to the state. That being said, of course, their job is to get the budget done by April 1st. And when they don't, it just sort of feeds into the increasing cynicism of New Yorkers that their state government is, you know, doesn't get things done like they're supposed to. But as a practical matter, vendors getting paid, public employees getting paid, services being delivered, the lights being on in state government, if the budget's late by a couple of weeks, it doesn't have any sort of dramatic impact. Now, we've seen in the olden days, when the budgets were late by months, that it does create problems for vendors and for delivery of services. But in recent years, probably over the past 15, that hasn't happened.
Wow. So anyway, there are big budget items you have written that are festering while the debate plays out. For example, how will state leaders pull together enough money to plug the MTA's expected budget gap of nearly $3 billion? Lawmakers have so far rejected the governor's plan to raise the transit costs for suburban areas, and the New York City mayor is opposing the governor's proposal to take $500 million, it's not chump change, out of the city's budget to support the MTA. What do you make of that?
Well, this sort of goes back to the previous question. And one of the reasons why the budgets are late is because the governor insists on something being added to the budget, often something that has really very little to do, if anything, to do with the budget at all. So this year, I was at a press conference that the speaker had, and when asked about what's being discussed at the budget tables, he said, bail, bail, bail. And what he was talking about is the governor's proposals to reform the New York system of how judges have discretion in terms of figuring out what the bail should be for an alleged perpetrator. And that is not really a budget item. I mean, of course, in the sense that everything's part of the budget, you can make the argument, sure. But it's not really central to the budget. And because of that, issues like what you just mentioned on the MTA and where's the money going to come from, all of those issues sort of can chug along to getting 90% done, but then they're frozen until the big ticket item gets done, because that's when the horse training starts. We don't really know what's going to happen necessarily on the funding of the MTA, but one of the major financial, could be a very serious financial problem for the state, is what happens to the MTA because of the pandemic, because of poor budgeting over the years, and the fact that you can't really function, the city of New York cannot function without a good mass transit system. The state's going to have to come up with some dough to make that happen. And how they're going to do it, I think, is anyone's guess. Generally speaking, Albany likes to kick the can on the MTA. But because of the pandemic and the weakening finances, I don't think they can keep kicking the can after this year.
Well, if they keep kicking the can, sooner or later the can is going to hit Charlie right in the behind.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And you're exactly right. And it plays out across the board. I mean, you look at the public colleges all across the state. They're losing enrollment. The state has been, you know, shifting the costs onto family members. The governor's proposing to keep doing that. And what's the state's policy to reverse that trend? Well, you can't tell until the budget sort of comes together, and that's frozen because of the debate over what should be done over bail reform.
Now, let me ask you this. What about the fact that the budget is negotiated mostly in secret, two women and a man in the room?
Yeah, and of course, any negotiation where you have a lot of people involved and a lot of high stakes, at some point people have to discuss sort of off the record how they're going to handle it. And so in every negotiation, a portion of it is done in secret, no matter what it is. But in Albany land, the budget can also get derailed because of insistence on topics that no one had thought about in advance or had proposed. So last year, for example, out of nowhere, the governor decided to jam through a big subsidy for the Buffalo Bills' new football stadium. And this year, she decided to try to jam through at the last minute with no preparation, as far as I could tell, a plan to weaken the state's climate law because of concerns over affordability. That program had been in the works for years. And nobody raised any, well, not nobody, but the governor's office said there were no problems until like a week ago. And so when you're in secret, bad things can happen, even if I think everyone would recognize that portions of sort of figuring out how you're going to come to an agreement between three different views on the budget, the Assembly, the Senate, and the governor, has to be to some extent discussed in private. The problem is because of the over-reliance on secrecy, bad things can happen in the budget that cost New Yorkers an arm and a leg. And that's the part that's the biggest problem.
Well, yes, it's the biggest problem, but the New Yorkers even know that it's there, that it's a problem.
Well, they'll notice if the governor's proposals advance on climate change, they'll notice it because the state will have more pollution. And if they don't handle her concerns over costs properly, they'll notice it when they go to pay for gasoline or turn on their electricity in their house and see their bill. So, yeah, I mean, they'll see it, but unfortunately, it's way after the fact. And so that's why the secrecy in Albany has always worked in the sense of horse trading, is because people don't feel the impacts until after the fact. And then, you know, after the fact, it's hard to change it.
Now, you spoke recently with my old friend Liz Bishop of WRGB-TV. I used to be on with her every night. And you told her oil companies should pay for damage caused by climate change. Can you give us more specifics on that?
Yeah. You know, right now, the state is going to be spending tens of billions of dollars to deal with the costs of rising sea levels, more intense storms, hotter temperatures, more air pollution. All that sort of stuff is sort of baked in to certainly the immediate short term and the medium term, my guess, as well, because of the burning of greenhouse gases. And it's already started. The plant's already heating up. We're already starting to feel the consequences. For those of us who've been in Albany a long time, they notice there's a lot less snow. All of that stuff is sort of, you know, percolating along, and the planet's getting worse, and the world's experts are going crazy that we have to do something. So the question is, if the state is going to have to spend tens of billions of dollars to sort of deal with its infrastructure, who should pay? Right now, the way it's going to pay is you, Alan, me, and all of the listeners to this show are the ones who are going to have to pay, both in terms of potentially worse infrastructure, but certainly higher taxes, to deal with all of these consequences. My argument to Liz was the state should instead try to figure out a way, and we have a bill that we're working on that's in the state Senate's one house budget that says the oil companies should pay because it's their fault. They're the ones who knew 50 years ago that this was going to be a problem and then lied about it. They still are. They have the money. In the last 2 years, the biggest oil companies made $600 billion in profits. So they have the money. Their fault. Make them pay. So and make them pay in a way that the cost can't be passed on to the public.
So what's the likelihood that'll happen?
Well, you know, you're talking to an eternal optimist, Alan. I mean, my three words that I live by are, yes, hope springs eternal. Those are the three words that I live by. The state Senate put a proposal in its one-house budget that does just what I'm just describing, forces the oil companies to pay $3 billion a year for the next 25 years to offset the cost to New York. and it does it in a way that costs won't be passed on to consumers. Whether or not it's in the final budget, who knows? This is, comes back to our earlier discussion on secrecy around the budget. We've been told, but we don't know this for a fact, we've been told that it's the governor's office that's blocking it in negotiations at the same time as she was pushing to weaken the state's climate laws. Are those two things connected? Who knows? Are both of those things true? It's hard to know that, too. But yeah, you would think that making the oil companies pay should be at the top of the list. And we'll see what happens.
Blair Horner, ethics reform. Is there anything in this budget that deals with it? Where are we?
Nah, it's, you know, it's bad. You know, in Albany, they say when once we do something, you know, come back to us in a couple of years. And they blew up the old ethics commission last year and replaced it with a new one, which is more or less, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss sort of set up. And yes, there are things that should be done to make it independent. And there's nothing in the budget, really, of any consequence that would improve that. You know, so the expectations are pretty low that Albany's going to tackle this issue. Well, you never know. One, you know, we're one corruption charge away from everybody wanting to do something again. But we'll see. That being said, there is one piece that they could do. The failed effort to get Hector LaSalle as the head of the Court of Appeals, which is New York's highest court, there was all this lobbying being spent on both sides, for him and against him. And it turns out that all that lobbying is not considered lobbying under New York law. And so there's legislation in the Senate and the Assembly by Assemblymember John McDonnell from the Albany area to close that loophole. So there's possibilities that some good things could happen. But the fundamental construct, how it's set up, it's still appointed by the ethics agency, it's still appointed by the legislative leaders, and are truly independent. All of that those problems are still there and will fester until or unless the agency, you know, starts going down the wrong path like all of its predecessors.
So how unethical is Albany? I mean, it's a broad question, but nobody is better equipped to handle it than you.
Well, you know, it's a hard question to answer because it's sort of based on how do you view ethics. So, you know, government in a democracy is made up of human beings. And so you're going to have angels, you're going to have devils, and then you're going to have everybody, all of us in the middle. Right. And so you try to construct systems that keep the middle of the bell curve on the straight and narrow. And that really hinges on things like transparency and openness. So that decisions are made as much as possible in the open and people can see what's going on and it's not campaign contributors driving the process, that it's really what's best for the public that's what's driving the process. And then you try to have a system in place where somebody's watching all of that and can act to do something if somebody behaves badly. The same way as when we're all driving on the thruway, we drive faster until we see a speed trap and then we all slow down. Because we might, you know, we might be the person that gets the speeding ticket. And so in Albany, it's always been those two problems where everything, the default setting, the muscle memory is to do things in secret. And then to never create an agency that's sufficiently independent that can sort of deter the people in the middle of the bell curve from doing bad things. I mean, there's, you know, there's the state attorney general's office, there's the U.S. attorney's offices across the state that sort of can go after the bad guys. But, you know, getting people in the middle to stay on the straight and narrow, I mean, that's the normal person's default setting. But if they're watching people cutting corners all the time, then everybody starts to cut the corners. And you have to create a culture. So your question about is it, I think the vast majority of everybody who works in government are ethical. And so that's not the problem. But we don't have the systems in place to deter big problems. And we saw in the previous administration all sorts of corruption scandals that came out of a secretive, you know, contracting process, for example, that brought in U.S. Attorney Preparara, as well as problems with the legislature. The same sort of problems. You have a closed system that nobody knows what's going on other than a handful of top, you know, individuals. And sometimes they game the system.
We're talking to Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Blair, you are Mr. Good Government. So I don't know if I've asked you this, but what's in the bigger, better bottle bill?
That's the connection. There was sort of a leap But I got it. So there's a proposal, and it's in the state Senate's budget, and could be in the final budget, may not be in the final budget, who knows, to take the state's 40-year-old this year bottle deposit law and modernize it. So there's all these new packages that have come onto the market since 1983 that are not covered under the law because the law says, you know, beer, soda, bottled water, wine coolers, you know, everything else is it. So you get a sports drink or you get a, you know, a juice, not in. And so a modern system would say, okay, well, all beverage containers except for dairy should be in the bottle bill, the bottle law system. It works. It's about 2/3 of the containers that are covered by the current law are redeemed. So you want to, how do you improve that? Well, you can improve it by increasing the deposit. It's been a nickel for 40 years, and I think all of us would agree that a nickel in 1983 purchased more than it does in 2023. If you adjusted it for inflation, it'd be 15 cents. So the proposal is to raise it to a dime, which is, you know, consistent with Connecticut and some of the other states across the country, and to expand the number of containers so that more system, more trash, litter, potential litter is collected and returned to the system. You lighten the recycling and solid waste burdens of municipalities that have to currently cart the stuff off to some landfill. And you're creating a sort of a circular system where people who make the products and put them in packages are ultimately responsible for disposing or recycling those deposits. So that's sort of the system that's being proposed. There's interest in both houses. Whether or not it's in the budget or it gets done after the budget, I think it's hard to tell right now. But there's a lot of interest. There are hundreds of groups and businesses that support it. And it's, you know, on the table in the budget negotiations, as far as we can tell as of now.
Okay, so Blair, on health care, the governor's proposal expands existing programs to provide additional coverage, but that still leaves too many New Yorkers without coverage. What say you?
Yeah, New York has done a pretty good job of providing coverage. It's about 95% of New Yorkers have some form of coverage, either provided by the government or their employer, or they purchase it themselves through the state's health exchange or whatever they do. And it tends to be expensive if you're purchasing it on your own, and it doesn't cover everybody. And so the state could reorganize. There's one, the most radical option would be to reorganize the entire system and just have sort of a Medicare program for everybody in the state. And that would be one way of providing universal coverage to everybody. It would probably be cheaper in the aggregate than the system that we have now, this sort of hodgepodge system, which, you know, you start to think about it, it's almost like you couldn't come up with a more crazy system than we have. It's very expensive. It's hard to understand. We don't live as long as other industrialized nations. So it's, you know, it's sort of a mess at every level, but it's hard to change because there's all these powerful forces. So certainly looking at programs to provide health insurance to undocumented immigrants, for example, in New York would be one way to expand it. Expanding the state's Medicaid program to capture more people that can't afford health insurance now, to provide a richer subsidy to the state's health exchange for sort of the lower middle income people that end up buying their own health insurance. I mean, those are all things that the state could do to expand its existing system, but it costs money, of course. Mm-hmm. Or you could go down a more radical approach, which would basically say no more health insurance companies in New York. The state would provide the coverage to everybody like the Medicare program does.
Blair Horner, Donald Trump was indicted and arraigned in a Manhattan court this week. D.A. Alvin Bragg, a Democrat, is leading the prosecution. Your thoughts on the charges and the stakes involved for Bragg going forward?
Well, I'm not in the position of knowing what the prosecutors know, nor in the position of knowing what the defense knows. So it's, you know, anytime you're talking about litigation, you always have to have had a good dose of humility going into taking a look at it. The charges are serious because even though most people may view hush money as not that big of a problem, it had those stories come out, whether or not they're true or not, of course, is another issue. But had they come out, it may have made a difference as to who got elected president of the United States in 2016. And so the implications are large. And, you know, the Manhattan district attorney argues that there are you know, legal violations that the former president was involved in, and therefore he should be held to account. Now, how where it goes from there, I mean, who knows, right? I mean, it's there's you got to challenge the evidence. We have to look at all of the accusations. There's a whole process that has to play out. So in terms of for Bragg, the Manhattan DA, I mean, it's both something that raises his visibility in New York, which Trump is not particularly popular in, but it also raises the stakes that if he has advanced a flimsy case and loses, he's going to look much worse. So, you know, again, we don't know what he knows, and the allegations are important because it may have affected the history of the country and the world. But, you know, Mr. Trump, just like everybody else, is innocent until proven guilty, and we'll have to see how that process plays out.
We have been talking, of course, to Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Group, or NYPIRG. Blair, always great to talk to somebody who really keeps his ear to the ground and knows what's going on. So we so appreciate your being with us.
Thanks for talking to me, Alan. It's always great to talk to you. And every listener should make sure they support WAMC.
Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org or just schedule a podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. Thanks for listening.